today, but I think that what I'm going to do instead, I'll talk about what I was going to do with the Lone Ranger, is pick up some of the things I was talking about yesterday and review them briefly, and then go on to a few other ways in which language gets in the way of communication, or the problems we have with language, and then talk a little bit about, since most of my sessions so far this summer have all ended on a kind of grim and pessimistic note, talk about ways in which language can be redeemed and made a useful tool, at least as I see it. But I'd like to begin by reading a poem that describes exactly the kind of difficulties with language that I was talking about yesterday. And this is the introduction to Songs of Innocence by William Blake. William Blake was an 18th century poet, painter, engraver, who was apparently almost a natural mystic. From childhood on, he saw no distinction whatsoever between the or no veil between the spiritual and the real world. He walked and talked with God as easily and perhaps more easily than with his classmates. He saw angels come and get his brother's soul at the moment of death when his brother died. He walked in the meadow and talked to God sitting in trees. In a very literal way, this was not metaphoric. Blake lived as easily in the spiritual world as in the other world. And so he recognized the tremendous problem in trying to... We talked yesterday about the taste of an orange. How can you ever communicate the taste of an orange? Always language is going to somehow interfere. And this is a beautiful poem that talks about what happens in the process. The child in this poem is many things to Blake. It's literally, I suppose, the Christ child. It's also Blake's imagination. It's the child in each one of us. It may be an angel. It may be the spirit of creativity. It is probably all of these things. But note the process that happens in this poem. Piping down the valleys wild, piping songs of pleasant glee, on a cloud I saw a child, and he laughing said to me, pipe a song about a lamb. So I piped with merry cheer, piper, pipe that song again. So I piped, he wept to hear. Drop thy pipe, thy happy pipe, sing thy songs of happy cheer. So I sung the same again, while he wept with joy to hear. Piper, sit thee down and write in a book that all may read. So he vanished from my sight, and I plucked a hollow reed, and I made a rural pen, and I stained the water clear, and I wrote my happy songs every child may joy to hear. These are the songs then that Blake writes in Songs of Innocence. The lamb and the tiger are two that you might remember. But notice the process as inspiration goes from God, who is its source, from the imagination, down through pure music. And here he's adopting a kind of Greek system that music is the highest of all the arts, and then song, because it mixes words with music, is a little less, and then finally you get down to writing on the printed page, and something has happened. In fact, the inspiration disappears. So he vanished from my sight. And then notice the process by which he describes how this beautiful image, these wonderful songs, get translated into words. And I plucked a hollow reed. Hollow, of course, to hold the ink, but also really literally empty. It's hollow. And I made a rural pen. The pen is scratchy, and the handwriting even gets in the way of things. And in order to make ink, I stained the water clear. Even the ink gets in the way of the process. And I wrote my happy songs every child may joy to hear. Why bother to write it all? So that everyone may read. Because your own imagination is private. Your own vision, your own contact with spiritual realities is a private kind of thing. So that what Blake is talking about then is language as a kind of necessary evil. In order to communicate, we have to use words.
But those words get in the way. They stain the clear water, not only to make the ink, but to make the idea presentable. I sort of like Paul Haines' idea, the our resident economist. The first second day we were here this summer, I saw Paul out on the lawn with his notebook in which he jots all sorts of things down, and he was running around the lawn with the open notebook, and he'd reach up and slap it shut like that. And I asked him what he was doing, and he said, "I'm catching ideas." But in the process of catching those ideas, he squashed them flat and distorted them, right, on the printed page. Precisely what Blake is talking about is what Paul Hayden was talking about. Okay, that's where we were yesterday then, and we were talking about the fact that because words are not things, and because words are cultural as well as purely communicative, that all these things get in the way and create a kind of literal veil between us. Okay, I'd like to talk a few more minutes about the way in which language inhibits us. Not only is language cultural, but I'm sure you've all had the experience of how personal it is too. Language is really an extension of us. It's not just something we use and put down. And therefore, it's always been harder for me, and I'm sure for most of you, to get a low grade on a piece of writing you've done, or a red mark, or all sorts of comments by the teacher, than it is to get an F or a D on a chemistry quiz. All an F or a D on a chemistry quiz shows you is that you didn't do your assignment, you didn't know that chemistry. And that, for most of us, is no big deal. It's neither here nor there. But an F or a D on a theme somehow says to that person, not only you spelled it wrong or you didn't say it right, but you're an F person. Don't we all take our writing more personally than we take anything else? I can recall a theme that a colleague of mine wrote the following remark on. This was about the fifth or sixth theme in the quarter in a series of 12. And he had a guy in his class who just could not write at all, who really tried. And his remark on the fifth theme was, "Congratulations, this is by far the best theme you've ever done, F." Okay, now that is humor at the expense, at the literal personal expense of a human being. I mean, and so as funny as that remark is, it'll stick with me forever. It's not the kind of thing that you ought to toy around with on a freshman theme. Writing is a personal thing. Not only is it a personal thing, but we come to have a kind of mystique or mystery about words, as if words were somehow magical things. That's not new. Witches and all other sorts of people who use incantations have always done the same sort of thing. But that enters in. Let me just give you a couple of examples of how that interferes with our way of operating. We have the feeling, particularly in Western culture, that somehow to say the word is to do the thing, to name the devil and thus get rid of him. And so we have taken all kinds of words which are normally curses, and we say that if we don't really say the whole thing, if we just say a part of it, it's perfectly acceptable. So instead of saying Jesus when we hit ourselves with a hammer or something, we say just the first syllable, G. Right? Or we transcribe it. Instead of saying Jesus, which is the swear word, nobody says that anymore, but we used to when we were kids, Judas Priest, right? It's not Judas, it's Judas, J-U-D-A-H apostrophe S, which is Christ, right? But see, somehow we've glossed it over and covered it up, and therefore it's not really really swearing. One of the most interesting words along these lines is gee-whiz. Gee whiz comes, if you have lived through the Roaring Twenties, gee whiz comes from, and earlier, from the famous American agnostic who used to go around on the Chautauqua circuits preaching against religion and making fun of Christianity. It's Ingersoll who used to, at the end of his very dramatic lecture, tear his shirt open and bare his chest to the heavens and saying, "If there is a God, let him strike me dead." And he would stand there dramatically for 10 seconds and prove, you know, quote unquote, prove his point. But Ingersoll's banners and the headlines in his publicity brochures had the following mocking phrase: "Jesus is coming just like a whiz." Well, if you take the first and the last sentences of words of that, "gee whiz," then suddenly you see everything's all right. You can say it. Everybody says "gee whiz" because we haven't really said the actual thing. One of the funniest uses of language in this respect, particularly in American culture, that we really haven't gotten over until, I would say the mid-50s, is the idea that on the stage or on television or in the movies, you can't really show either all the way through, you can't show a funeral or a wedding. Because would the actor and actress really be married if they both said, "I do"? And even though the minister is fake and just an actor playing the part, if he said, "I now pronounce you man and wife," wouldn't they really be married? And that's a kind of hang-up that the American public was not ready to take, was not grown up enough to take until 1950s. And now, if you go to a movie or on television, you'll see a wedding then all the way through. But we really have had a hang-up about that in our culture because somehow words have become incredibly mysterious. Okay, now on to one final difficulty that language presents, and it's in many ways the most hidden difficulty. It has to do with the very structure of the language itself. I suggested yesterday that English is Indo-European, and therefore it has a different way of looking at the world from other languages. Let me give you two examples of that. First of all, you cannot say a word in the English language without tense. Tense places something on a time scheme. You must, in any kind of information that you transmit in the English language or in all of the Indo-European languages, you must inform the person when that happened, or that it will happen, or that it would have happened. We get incredibly tied up with tense. So that a child then, growing up, learning English, implicitly learns, he doesn't have to be taught this, implicitly learns the importance of time. Furthermore, he learns, and that's why if you asked a five-year-old child to draw time, he would draw a line, and on that line he would put minutes and hours and centuries and so forth. He gets that from his language. We are time-oriented. In contrast to this, the Hopi Indian language and many of the other Indian languages have no tense whatsoever, because to them it is totally unimportant when something happened or that it will happen. If you asked a Hopi Indian to draw a picture of time, he would draw something like a snowball getting larger and larger and larger every day. He cannot segment it up into time. And therefore, just one difficulty with this, therefore, when you hire a Hopi Indian to work in your Motorola parts factory on the reservation, and you say, "Be to work at 8 o'clock, that means something to us because our language permits us that kind of division into time. Was, will be, shall be, would have been, and so forth. But the Hopi Indian, 8 o'clock literally does not mean the same kind of thing to him that it means to us at all. And therefore, if he shows up at 9 o'clock, we are wont to say, "What a lazy Indian, you can't depend on him." That's not it at all. He is operating under a kind of snowball of time in which there isn't this little segment. It is apparently, although this is hard for me to believe, it's apparently impossible for a Hopi Indian to be bored, because there is no half-hour segment while waiting for dinner to be bored in. He does not look at the world in that kind of way. Furthermore, just to give you one other contrast between the Hopi and the Indo-European languages, we must divide everything. Your English teachers insist upon this from first grade on. We must have, in order to have a complete sentence, a subject and a verb. And in doing that, we inevitably separate the subject from the action. And so it takes a poet like Yeats to begin to question who can tell the dancer from the dance. Do you really have a dance unless you have a dancer? Is a dancer unless he is dancing? In a very real way, you see, the world doesn't fragment itself in the way our language forces us to look at it fragmented. The Hopi Indian language doesn't always separate subject and verb. We are so religious in separating subjects and verbs that we have to invent subjects where none really exist, so that we have to say, it is raining. What is it? What time is it? You know, it is one of those funny little words that is sort of there because we have fragmented and separated things. The Hopi Indian simply has one word, which is the act of raining, and the rain too. It's all one. The result of this is, and although there are many other influences, I'm sure, but one of the results of this is that Western civilization have become the scientists. Because to be a scientist, you have to add, as Whitman says, you have to add, divide, chart, and measure. You have to separate things into fragments and see this part as opposed to this part. It is very easy for us, in other words, because of the language we speak, to be scientific about the world, to fragment it and measure it and add it and divide it. It is very easy, on the other hand, because of the language he speaks, for the Hopi Indian to be a mystic, to be one with the universe, to really be brothers with the eagle and with his fellow Hopi Indians and with the earth itself, the rocks and the stones and everything. In a way that for us to have this sense of oneness, this ecological sense that we are all parts of the same earth, is an incredible struggle. We have to overcome what our language from childhood on has trained us not to see. It's similarly difficult for the Hopi Indian because of the way in which he looks at all things as one, as this huge snowball in which his grandmother's death is just as real now as it was when it happened. It isn't set off in the past. It is easy, it is natural for a Hopi Indian to be a mystic, and it's very difficult for him to be a scientist. His language does not permit him to fragment and add and divide and measure. It's all one. So that a Hopi Indian's life is incredibly, each day, richer and richer and richer, because that snowball is getting larger and larger and larger. Whereas we can say, boy, I wish I was 20 again. Well, for us, you see, that happened way in the past. And we dropped it when we reached 30. And we dropped 30 when we reached 40. And so we run along this thin little timeline that our language has taught us to see. Now, what is reality out there? Is reality the way the Hopi Indian sees it, or is it the way the Indo-European languages see it, or is it the way other languages see it? There are some languages in which absolutely insist not upon tense, not upon time and the importance of time, but instead insist upon who you are speaking to. Is it a friend? Is it a stranger? Is it an enemy? And so they become who-oriented. They become very interested in people, as interested in people as we are in time, because of the language construct. No, I don't think, in spite of our romantic notions about the Indian, that the Hopi has the truth sitting in relating to the eagle on the mesa, nor do I think that we have the whole truth. I think we all see parts of it. I'm not as pessimistic as most linguists today, who in fact suggest that we can never know what is out there, that we can never know the truth about reality in any way, because our language interferes completely with the process and absolutely blocks any understanding of what is out there beyond. One other way in which our language really has done us a disservice, however, and I don't want to leave before pointing that out, is the way in which the English language particularly is a language of opposites. A child, by the time he is 2 and has a vocabulary of 100 or 150 words, already knows that for every word in our language, there is an opposite. If there's a top, there's a bottom. If there's a front, there's a back. If there's a yes, there's a no. So far, so good. But he also learns, doesn't he, that friend, enemy. He very quickly learns teacher, student. And I suggest that there are no, those divisions are highly artificial. Good and bad. Good and evil. I don't think a teacher is ever just a teacher, nor is a student ever just a student. But our language forces us to look at things in that way. In a way, for instance, that the Chinese language doesn't permit at all. The Chinese language sees a subtle series of gradations. Vern Rieke, who attends Holden, is on the Holden board, and sort of really makes this village swing when he's here, flew with the Flying Tigers in World War II in China. And he talked about how annoying it was to ask a Chinese pilot, well, will you do this tomorrow? And the pilot in English had to say yes, no, or maybe, but usually it was yes or no. When given the language in which he was trained, there's no way in which he could say absolute yes. All he can mean is a series of words that say it's increasingly more probable that I will do it than that I won't do it. But I don't know that I really can do it. Will you have the shirts ready tomorrow? Yes. If you come, they're not ready. Therefore, you say lazy Chinaman, you know, undependable. It's not undependable. His language is giving him different kinds of thoughts and forcing him to think in a different structure. So the Tower of Babel is literally true. We each see reality through the telescope, and quite often it's the wrong end of the telescope of our language, and the difficulty that arises from that is really what I'm talking about. Let me come back a little bit to the opposites. Take a look at how many titles of novels have this and this, the high and the mighty, the red and the black, the this and the this. We go on endlessly with this kind of fragmentation. The end, then, result of all of this, as I began by saying yesterday, is that somehow, unless you learn to control language, that language ends up controlling you. It's a process that you can never get away with completely. Okay, now what I wanted to do today, but I'm going to go on to other things. What I wanted to do today was talk very literally about the Lone Ranger and the way in which language used in popular mythology really controls the way in which we look at things. And I wanted to use the Lone Ranger specifically because it seems to me that one of the most incredible myths that children learn in America is a dramatic reversal. I don't know how to put this briefly, but is a dramatic reversal of the old idea of chivalry, which put the woman on the pedestal way up there, representing the spiritual element, and the man, the knight in shining armor, representing the earthly, the human element. In a very real way, beginning long before the Lone Ranger, but participating all the way down through the Lone Ranger and Gunsmoke and so forth, somehow America has reversed this myth to the point where it's the cowboy or the American male who is the innocent, the romantic, the visionary, the spiritual element, and the woman in our culture has taken her place as the materialist, the schemer, the reasoner, the wily person. The cowboy is out there where never has heard a discouraging word, and the skies are not cloudy all day. Invariably, none of which was true. 70% of the cowboys, in fact, were black slaves who had no place to go after the Civil War. All of the, you know, we have really done a hatchet job on the history of the West. But at any rate, take a look at any cowboy movie. Out from the West, out from the East, on the train representing civilization comes the young girl. She is invariably a school teacher, bringing English particularly. and I say English particularly because the very next scene you see is that poor, dumb cluck of a cowboy who was happy and gay, shooting up people and so forth. you never really see him working very much, sitting there in the back of the sixth grade class in a seat much too small for him, spelling out C-A-T. He is being civilized. He is being brought low. He's being made materialistic. And at the end of the scene, when at the end of the movie, you have a choice. If the cowboy kisses his horse and goes off with his companion, who is always, in our culture, for some strange reason, a member of a minority race, whether it's the Tonto or Huckleberry Finn with the black slave Jim, or Ishmael and Moby Dick with Queequeg, there's a strange sort of thing going there, too. At any rate, if he kisses the horse and goes off, all the boys in the audience cheer, but if he kisses the girl, he also symbolically takes off his guns, hands them to his sidekick, gets on a buckboard instead of a horse, drives off with supplies to start a farm or a ranch, and has been brought low by the woman. Isn't this myth perpetuated almost throughout our culture? Dagwood and Blondie are a perfect example. Where would that marriage be if it weren't for Blondie's know-how? Dagwood can't do a thing right. He is what Bernard Iddings Bell, the Anglican priest, called a perennial adolescent. But isn't that true of Archie Bunker? Isn't that true of Little Abner? Isn't that true of Pappy Yoakum? Look who runs the family there and goes to the PTA. It's not Pappy Yoakum, who is just a drone. It is Mammy Yoakum. It's the women in our society who scheme and get the wheels of progress rolling. And the men are very literally adolescent. Adolescent in all sorts of ways, not only in popular literature, but in great literature. Tom Sawyer looks at women in exactly the same way that most 10 to 15-year-old boys look at women. That is, fragmenting them into the types. There's the lusty girl. Little Abner does a perfect job of this. There's the beautiful young girl next door, always blonde, whom one is going to marry. She is sweet and lovable. But then there's the lusty, sexy babe. Then there is the good Aunt Polly-type mother from Tom Sawyer. And there's the sterile Widow Watson. There's the mean witch type women. If you take a look at American Lit, look at how much we have really avoided grown-up problems in our literature. Moby Dick sends Ishmael and the whole crew off where there are no women at all, so that never becomes a problem. There is hardly in American writing, pop or otherwise, there is hardly a mature picture of either an adult relationship or a truly real, whole woman. We have no Anna Karenina's, Madame Bovary's, or even Lady Macbeth's in our culture. And I suggest that one of the powers of language, when it coalesces into myth, is to really shape the way in which we look at things. Boys, I mean, men in our culture are still small boys, playing in lodges, playing at this, playing games. Our jobs are mostly monopoly of a more refined kind, and so forth. And I think this has done, you know, countless damage to our relationships. It has helped keep us, and I really agree with Bell, it has helped keep us perennial adolescents. At any rate, I was going to trace the development of the way in which we reverse the roles. Let me give you just one example of how prevalent in our culture this is. 6 or 7 years ago, when bomb shelters were the in thing, I gave one of those tests that some of you are probably familiar with, in which I put 8 people in a bomb shelter for my students at the end of a section on reasoning. In a bomb shelter that would only hold 5, so they had to kick 3 out. It's your bomb shelter, you have to decide who goes. Okay, there was a black who was the only one strong enough to lift the door to the bomb shelter by himself, but of course any other 2 men could have done it. There was a home ec major who knew how to cook and knew dietary problems, but she couldn't play the guitar or anything like that. There was a really sexy babe, and there was a psychiatrist and a minister. And there was a pregnant woman. Okay. Now, I had all sorts of fun. A lot of people decided the black ought to go because they didn't want prejudice rearing its ugly head down there. Almost everybody kicked the minister out because, A, the people going out are really going to need him. B, second most prevalent reason they kicked the minister out, who's more prepared to meet God? And C, there were four reasons that I just got all the time from 75 different students. C, he'd sure feel terrible left behind, knowing his place was given to somebody else. And then D, with a psychiatrist down there who needs a minister. So that'll give you some idea of the quality of the students I was dealing with. But the interesting thing came in the way in which they handled the pregnant woman. Not a boy in class threw her out. You've got to give the unborn child all the kind of schnaltzy, syrupy, romantic reasons that you could think of. You can't do that to this poor woman is going through enough the way it is. You can't send her out to certain death. Give the child a chance. You know, all those kinds of reasons. Not a single girl in any of my three sections kept the pregnant woman. What if she had a miscarriage? What if something was wrong with the baby? You can't have another life. You can't. All the practical, cold, cruel, you know, heartless reasons that you could think of. You've got to give the unborn child all the kind of schnaltzy, syrupy, romantic reasons that you could think of. You can't do that to this poor woman is going through enough the way it is. You can't send her out to certain death. Give the child a chance. You know, all those kinds of reasons. Not a single girl in any of my three sections kept the pregnant woman. What if she had a miscarriage? What if something was wrong with the baby? You can't have another life. You can't. All the practical, cold, cruel, you know, heartless reasons that you could think of. Suggesting to me, at least, that we have really bought this myth that somehow the woman is the materialist. Maybe it's not a myth. Maybe we've discovered the truth in American culture, and the Europeans and the old code of chivalry were wrong. But we have done a beautiful job of reversing that myth in our culture through the power of the written word, coming, I suppose, originally from life. Okay, now, how to get back together again? What happens? How do you overcome these difficulties of language? See through these myths, use language in a fresh way. And I suggested yesterday, I guess, that one of the ways of doing that is listen to what children do. Because I think what they do on a more serious and larger scale is precisely what each of us needs to do too. And that is to see the world through their own eyes and not let somebody else do their thinking for them. Not to see clouds as fluffy, but to see it as they really see it. To see out their window, and I'll explain that analogy in a minute. I do have just a couple of examples this morning from my own family. This drawing on a board was done by Jonathan at the age of, six or seven. If you don't recognize what it is, this is the blackboard is a sheet of paper. It is a brontosaurus. But it was too big to get on the paper. Now, that's beautiful because most of us, the minute we see an 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper, we've got 8.5 by 11 minds, right? Preachers within 3 years end up with 25-minute minds. College teachers are a little better. We've got 50-minute minds. But we all put ourselves in those kinds of boxes that Erling Jorstad was talking about at Tuesday Vespers, in a way that Jonathan is just now learning, unfortunately, to do. But he wasn't limited by that paper. He went off it. All you see are two legs and a little bit of tail. The thing was too big. On the way out here, we came through Sheridan and then came down the mountains toward the Yellowstone National Park, and Margaret and I were talking about how many twists and turns, to quote to cop a phrase, as they say, twists and turns the road had and hairpin curves. In other words, we were using all the cliches, except for Gretchen, who looked out the window and said, "Wow, this is a squiggly road." And that's nice. I mean, you see, somewhere along the line, that's going to get knocked out of her. Two other examples. Jonathan, 3 years ago, when he was six, was out here, and his favorite occupation was digging holes around the village looking for toads or damming up the streams and so forth. And we were sitting at a Vespers one night, at which I forget who was speaking, but at this Vespers service, whoever was talking again and again and again about the fact that God is everywhere, which is a common Holden theme. And Jonathan finally, after being very, very perplexed and worried, leaned over to Margaret and said, "If I dig a hole, will I find him?" Kids also have a way of seeing through the corn and the pretense, almost unseeingly. I don't think kids are wise. I like Wordsworth's phrase, when he called a child an eye among the blind, but without knowing it himself. Two examples from that category. We have at Augustana one of the few rituals left that we celebrate, commencement having long since lost its importance, the crowning during homecoming of the Viking and the Viqueen, the royalty. They dress up in purple robes. There are incredibly ornate wooden thrones they sit on a stage, and at the most dramatic moment, as the college song is being sung or hummed softly and everybody is reverently standing, the president comes down the aisle and kneels before the king and the queen, the president of the college. Wow, what a great moment, you know. And everybody is sucked into this except for one little kid of a religion professor who at the quietest moment in a very loud voice asks, "Is Jesus coming?" Now, suddenly you begin to see, you know, how you have been taken in. One final example, Gretchen, you know how we treat kids, how we talk down to kids. We don't really realize it until our bluff is called. And so a couple of years ago, when Gretchen was two and just learning, you know, the colors and so forth, the pastor's wife happened to be passing through the nursery one day, and Gretchen was there, and Gretchen pointed to a fire truck and said, "What color is that?" And the pastor's wife said, "Red." And Gretchen said, "Very good." That is, I think, how we need to see the world again. I really like... Let me use two analogies, one from Henry James and the other from C.S. Lewis, to kind of close this session. Henry James has a beautiful analogy called The House of Fiction that is a preface to one of his novels, in which he says that life is much like a house with an incredible number of rows of windows on one side, all facing a courtyard. The courtyard is life, the world, the universe. And each window hides a human being, an artist in the bud or an actual artist. Each of those artists sees that courtyard from a slightly different perspective, some from quite a different perspective. The window down here and the window up here really look at the same thing, but what they see is quite different, and what they notice is quite different. Each of us, says Henry James, is imprisoned by our language, by our customs, by our training, by our own temperaments, whether we're bubbly or morose or despondent or gay, by all the things that have happened to us. We are each in a prison of ourselves, kept there by custom and habit and temperament and language. So that Thomas Hardy, as he looks down on the window, sees nothing but despair, foreordained by God to be miserable forever after. Joseph Conrad, who is a contemporary of Thomas Hardy's, is looking apparently at the very same thing, and he sees nothing but the opportunity for heroism, for joy. T.S. Eliot, a little later, looks down from another window and sees a wasteland. We are hollow men, our headpieces filled with straw. Who is right and who is wrong? Well, what James is trying to show is that in literature, unlike science, one new discovery does not disprove necessarily an old discovery. In the way, once the world is proved to be round, it no longer ever can be square. All these windows are simply seeing, if they're honest and if they're truthful, they are looking at reality from their own perspective and telling their own slice of truth. Nobody can see whole. Nobody can see it all. And because Thomas Hardy looks at the gloom, the Bible is even a better example, as Vern Fiatox taught it to us in the Bible studies while he was here. We have the Jeremiah window, which is incredibly gloomy. How can that book be in the same Bible with the Song of Songs or with the Psalms? Each one is different. And in those 66 windows with which we look at God, we get an incredible kind of perspective and an incredible kind of understanding that we wouldn't have if we simply lived with one of those windows. Okay, how do you communicate from window to window? Well, I can communicate by newspaper or history. That is, I can send up information. This is what I see out my window, the following 10 things. But that, says James, isn't really giving the person a sense of your window. In order to give the person a sense of your window, the one thing you need is art. That is, somehow you have to make what you see out your window truly alive to another human being. Through painting, through music, or through the imperfect language that we have. Hamlet is not successful if you're just reading words. It's only successful if, for a moment, you are outside your window and looking at life through Shakespeare's window. Art at its best, poetry at its best, even refreshing pictures of one-quarter dinosaurs at their best, can do that kind of thing. They can shake us outside our window and broaden our understanding. So James's point is, the best thing to do is not only to see life out your window and tell the truth as you see it, but experience as many other windows as you possibly can. And the end result of that, for James, is the dismissal of prejudice. The more windows you come, the more perspectives on life you come to have, the better you're going to be. Keeping in mind, however, that you are given a window too, and it is your responsibility, first of all, to make sure the window is clean and not rose-covered or dirty or distorted in some way, as clean as you can keep it. And then be honest about what you see out there. Don't say, well, wow, window C saw clouds as fluffy or saw mice as quiet, and therefore I better say quiet as a mouse, or I better say fluffy clouds. Say what you see out your window, and only then are you going to make a contribution to the other windows. If you give up your window for somebody else's vision, if you give up your language for somebody else's language, that is not going to happen. C.S. Lewis, I think, put it where I would agree with it most. In the second of his science fiction series, Perelandra, in which a person from Earth is sent to Venus to prevent the devil from causing a new Adam and Eve, who have just been created there by God, to fall, and is successful at the end in preventing from what happened to Earth from happening all over again. Almost like Moses, as a reward, the ransom, who is the main character, is taken up by God into the universe and shown the future, which C.S. Lewis calls the cosmic dance. The dance of everything back into one. And I really like to think of the world and of the function of language, and particularly the function of poetry, as, in a sense, taking this world which at the fall was shattered and fragmented into 1,000 bits and 1,000 languages at the Tower of Babel, and bringing it back together again. God, in other words, is arranging the dance through men's imaginations. Because what your imagination does is exactly what a child does. He sees relationships between things. Every time you see a new relationship, see something in a new way. See the relationship between a squiggle on a page and a road. You have helped to participate in bringing together everything back into the cosmic dance. It's all one, finally, and that is where we're heading. When you misuse language, you participate in the fragmentation. When you use it honestly, I was going to say correctly, and I don't really mean correctly. When you use it honestly and clearly and in your own way, you are doing precisely, I think, what it is the function of all artists, and we're all artists, I'm sure, what it is the function of art to do. Okay, I had intended to give you three windows by three religious poets to show you the wide diversity of ways in which they could look. But let me just end with one window, and it's a window that Carol is going to open to us Friday night when he reads Gerard Manley Hopkins. Let me just show you one of these windows and the way in which suddenly things can come together and be refreshed by a man who is honest enough to see things his way. The poet Gerard Manley Hopkins was a 19th century poet who was a Jesuit priest and burned most of his early poetry because he did not think it was under orders of his superiors. He did not think it was befitting a Jesuit priest to write poetry. But fortunately, some of it survived. What Hopkins does in his poetry